Hi, and welcome back to Art Pod. I'm your host, Kate Wells, and this is the podcast where we bring you the artists and thinkers and culture makers in Michigan that we are following now. We are going to kick everything off with something a little bit different that we haven't done before with Art Pod. We're going to bring you an extended bonus version today. That's because we want to have enough room for something a little special. It's actually kind of a familiar story, at least in Michigan. Maybe you remember back in 2008 when General Motors shuttered a plant just outside of Grand Rapids. And obviously for a lot of people, that was the end of their jobs, the end of where they had grown up, the end in a lot of ways of that community. But for one guy, he decided that this was the beginning. His name is Austin Bunn. He's a professor at Grand Valley State University. And when that plant shuttered, he spent the next 4 years talking with people who had worked at the plant. And the result of that work is a documentary play called Rust. It was originally produced at the Actors Theater of Grand Rapids, and then it debuted on Michigan Radio at Stateside. And what you're going to hear right now is the radio adaptation of the play.
This is a story about what happens to the people who make things when we stop making things. 4 years ago, I moved to Michigan for a teaching job, and the close of this auto plant was all over the news.
General Motors announcing that it is closing its plants on 36th Street here in Wyoming, a move that will cost 1,200 people their jobs.
Heard the news and cannot believe it.
Shock and sadness on the floor of the factory.
And I just can't tell you how bad I feel for what's going on today in this community, in this plant.
The feeling of a funeral, of a wake down here, Rachel.
Yeah, very sad. Some people are so sad.
If you've ever lived in the Rust Belt, these kinds of announcements are not new. Plant closings got so bad in the early 80s that they had a bumper sticker: last one out of Michigan, turn off the lights. But I had just moved to Grand Rapids, about 15 minutes away from Wyoming, and the idea that 1,200 people would lose their jobs, including the mayor of Wyoming who worked at the plant, was shocking to me. What would happen to them? What would they do now? My father lost his job in his 50s, and he never had full-time work again. It changed him. He lost the plot. I thought maybe if I met the people who worked at the plant and understood what they were going through, I could find out how people get from one way of life to another. Now, I'm not a radio producer, I'm a playwright. I did almost 100 interviews with the people who worked at that plant, but I've learned you can't get 100 voices on the radio. So I distilled down what I heard and then worked with actors to portray the cast of characters that I met over 3.5 years of interviewing. So let's start with a tour. The plant on 36th Street in Wyoming looks like an enormous box. It stretches for what must be a half a mile. It sits next to a railway line and a highway. There's a bank across the street and a school nearby. A gate surrounds the place, covered in barbed wire. When I pull into the visitor's lot, I realize my tiny Honda is the only non-GM, non-gigantic truck in the place.
Yeah, smell that? See, you can't smell the oil anymore. That's how you know it's really over.
This is Dave, the head of the union and my tour guide. When I went to meet him at the plant, he was one of just a few people left.
Where is everybody?
Laid off, transferred, retired, what have you. Skeleton crew now.
So what am I looking at? Tell me about this layout. Can we walk? Is
that
okay?
Yeah, sure. Let me show you this place here. Okay. You've got, first, way over there, up top, that's the offices.
Okay.
And in the back, you got production. Okay. You know what a die is?
No.
As we walk around the place, I keep seeing these little habitats, evidence of the people that work there. A post-it note on an abandoned toolbox that says, "Dan is gone." A barrel full of work boots.
Well, it's just hard to understand what happened here with it so empty.
You should have been here 6 months ago.
The place is a ghost town.
Hello?
I want to meet some of the ghosts.
Is anybody here?
It was just supposed to be a summer thing.
So I'm 22, with a wife, kid, no job.
My husband said, "You can't do this."
Nobody was born wanting to be an auto worker.
I looked at what I'd be making in the plant and then what I'd be making in any other job, and
the choice was obvious.
40 hours instead of 70.
And make the same money.
It's a big place.
You used to not even be able to see through there because the air was so bad.
People had been killed there.
Crushed. The dyes, the steel.
Stuff weighs a frickin' ton.
We've had 8 people die in there since it opened. Good day at GM was when you got home with 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Will you miss this place?
The building? Nah, but the people. And right here is where we got the news, up there on the podium.
It was 2 o'clock, and they told us to stop what we were doing.
This is Heather, one of the skilled laborers at the plant.
We knew it was nothing good. They weren't going to shut every section down to meet for something good.
Effective immediately, the
we were just numb.
Heather had 2 sons, and her husband was unemployed because of health problems.
After the announcement, nobody was doing anything. I'd be at my station, and a guy would come over. I don't remember who was the first. It got to be so many. Usually he wouldn't say anything, just stand there. I mean, a guy's not going to go up to another guy and tell him how he's feeling, right? And then he'd start. What if I lose the house? How am I going to tell my family? What if I get transferred to Indiana or farther?
Faced with the end of her job at the plant, Heather was hoping for a transfer to Lansing, about an hour away. She became one of the GM gypsies, one of hundreds.
You want some tequila? Come on.
This is Rick, an electrician at the plant.
I wasn't surprised the place closed. I'm surprised it took this long. Come on, there's a guy that worked there. They keep promoting him, even though we suck. Like, he's a supervisor, and everyone hated him so much, they had to move him. So they made him the supervisor of the supervisors, I guess. No one liked him even then, so you know, they promoted him again. This plant closing? That's not a tragedy. I mean, my wife and I, we lost 2 kids. That's a tragedy. Plant was a click. That little boy running around here, I'm transferring because it's all about that little boy. I'm just a migrant worker.
Out of 1,200 employees at the plant, 700 transfer elsewhere. A few hundred retire, and the rest take a buyout, which means losing their pension. Hundreds of people start moving out of town, out of state, anything to hang on to their jobs. I'm coming to understand that mobility has been a General Motors way of life. They close one plant, they open another. Creative destruction, economists call it. Alfred P. Sloan, the former president of General Motors, gave it a different name.
I call it another epic American migration.
From Sloan's 1926 autobiography, Adventures of a White-Collar Man.
There is no one so hopeless as a worker exiled from his family, surrounded by factory after factory. We must take the work out of the industrial centers and into America.
This strategy to decentralize and scatter plants across the country wasn't just a boon for small towns like Wyoming. It was an attempt to escape the force of unions forming in Detroit, where GM had its headquarters. In 1936, workers at a GM plant in Flint formed the United Auto Workers and struck for better pay. The plant in Wyoming, Michigan, almost 2.5 hours from Flint, opened a year later. After the plant went dark, the UAW closed its shop and employees had a final picnic. Workers threw their boots and hard hats high up into the branches of a tree that arced over the picnic tables. The plant got emptied out by demolition guys, and anything worth anything was sold at an auction. As one of the consultants told me, you can now make more money taking apart a plant than you could working there while it was open. I drive an hour north of Grand Rapids to meet a longtime GM tradesman named Jack. He worked at the Wyoming plant for 24 years.
Let me say this. GM was a great company.
He lives in a small trailer way out in the woods. I interview him on his deck. He's wearing a brace, and he tells me that he's got prostate cancer.
I know there's people that come home and hate everything they do, but I've always loved being a dye maker.
What shift were you on?
Third for most of it.
Wait, is third the
It's the night shift. Yeah, start at 11, finish at 7. I'd work, drive the kids to school in the morning. Then I'd climb into bed, and then finally get up to start dinner.
Man, that's rough.
It is rough.
We talked about Jack's surgery, and then the conversation began to change.
It's moved into my spine. I just had an operation. That's why I'm in this brace. I go back to work Monday.
Monday? You don't get any time to recuperate.
Can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
What's an individual driving a foreign car for?
You mean me? What am I doing?
I see your Honda parked out on my lawn. I think we're both trying to understand each other.
Well, I bought it when I was in graduate school. I had always heard that American cars were unreliable.
Now, who'd you hear that from?
I heard it from everyone I knew growing up.
Where?
In New Jersey.
The coasts always give us our biggest negativity.
Why would that be?
Who knows? I heard some GM employee bragging about what they made or how little they did. They see someone like Wagoner running GM, making, what, $17
million? $17 million? That doesn't bother you at all?
No, it doesn't. Wagoner worked hard. I worked hard. We're a capitalist country. I don't get mad at GM. I don't file workman's comp.
Do you think the cancer may have been a result of working in that place?
They've tied prostate cancer to metalworking fluids, and there's no prostate cancer in my family.
So you're not bitter?
GM gave me the opportunity and a couple of risks. Losing a job is a risk. Getting sick is a risk.
A big risk, sir.
Yeah, from where you sit and your reliable car.
I began to think after I interviewed Jack that this project was about loyalty, which frankly I don't understand. I don't think anybody my age would understand. In my work history, I've been a window dresser, a game designer for reality television, a journalist, and now a teacher. Every single one of those jobs I had in a different state. The world that Jack lived in, of working for the same company for decades, a company loyal to its workers, doesn't seem to exist anymore. What do we have instead? Freelance, free agency, freedom. But is the world a better place for it? Where does that loyalty go when it goes? If I was learning anything from the workers at the plant, it was that there was a freedom to loyalty, too. The freedom from a certain kind of anxiety. The typical American worker now spends just 4 years at his or her current job, which means that our time gets spent increasingly on negotiating that change. On asking the questions, where will I live, what will I do, am I useful, that the lifers at General Motors never had to ask. Until, of course, now. Meanwhile, General Motors just posted some of the biggest profits in 10 years. I kept thinking at some point with all these interviews, I'd meet the enemy, the guy responsible for closing the plant, for people losing their jobs, the proverbial axe man. And then finally, I did.
I drove the final nail. This is when I was at GM headquarters, or as I like to call it, my time in hell.
This is Don, the comptroller of the Wyoming plant. I interviewed him in his kitchen.
Closing a plant starts with a white paper for the executives.
I'm sorry, a white paper?
Yeah, a white paper. You did the basic public research, you know. You found out what businesses were hiring, or maybe GM could absorb some of the people without them being displaced. You know, I'd call a plant, ask some loaded questions, but you had to do it so the people never really could figure out what was going on. You don't want to tip your hand, so to speak, especially letting the workforce know. That's deadly.
After working in Detroit for a number of years, Don transferred to Wyoming and took over the plant.
I never thought a close would happen to me, but it didn't matter. They just kept ticking them off. Well, I put in 40 years, and my last day, I just snuck away. I did not want a party. When I got home, my wife had glass of scotch and a bowl of popcorn for me. That was it. But then Thanksgiving comes, and all my kids and grandkids were there. I don't know what got into me. I brought out this box, and it had all these plaques of recognition, a quality award that I won from the Chamber of Commerce. Kids had never seen any of it. I told them, this is my retirement party. You guys are the ones I work for. You guys are the ones who got me through.
Do you know why the car industry started in Michigan? The trees. Hickory used to cover the whole southern part of the state, and hickory wood is hard and dense, good for making carriages so they wouldn't break. The carriage companies take off in Michigan, and the carriage companies grow up into the car companies. I moved this year away from Michigan. I followed a job, another epic migration in a life of them. I'm a gypsy now. Before I left, I drove by the plant. There's nothing left. They've completed the demolition. I'd been interviewing folks from the plant for almost 4 years, and I felt like an anchor that had been holding me to the area was now gone. They're looking for a buyer for the location, what they now call Site 36. The sales pitch is slick and sounds like this.
Site 36 is a unique development opportunity located just outside Grand Rapids in the city of Wyoming. This 92-acre site was the former home to a General Motors stamping plant for 73 years.
The only thing that remains is one of the trees out front, one of the trees with the boots and the hard hats flown up into it. I parked out front, and I wondered what the new owners will think when they move in. Will they wonder what happened here or think about the people and the families that grew up in the shade of that tree? Does our hard work get somehow written into the places that we live? What happens if it doesn't? My heart felt heavy as I drove home. The next day, I packed up my things, and like so many of the folks that I'd interviewed, I got on the road.
You've been listening to a documentary play about the shuttering of a General Motors plant. The play is called Rust. It was written by Austin Bunn. And you can learn more about Bunn and the Actors Theater of Grand Rapids by visiting their websites. Okay, we're going to make one last stop today, this time to downtown Detroit. And maybe you missed this when it happened, but there was this big celebration in Detroit to mark spring. And while we're at it, you know, also drive out the devil from Detroit. You know, two things at once. It's actually an old festival called, I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly here, Marche du Nain Rouge. I'm terrible at French. You can tell I took Spanish. And Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick, she can pronounce this much better than I can, and which is a good thing since she's going to bring us the story.
So here's a quick history lesson about the Marche du Nain Rouge. Legend has it that Detroit's founder, one Antoine de la Motte Cadillac, battled with a red dwarf on the banks of the Detroit River back when the city was just a French trading outpost. The details of this mythical encounter are a little fuzzy, but the basic idea is that the Nain Rouge cursed Cadillac and Detroit, and has been responsible for the city's many ill fortunes ever since. So Detroiters used to gather every year on this day to symbolically drive the Nain out of town. They did it in costume because, the story goes, that way the Nain couldn't come back to seek revenge. That tradition petered out some point many years ago, but it's been revived by some serious Detroit history buffs in the past 4 years. Now it's part nod to Detroit's French past, part spring cleansing ritual, and a fun way to vent frustrations with Detroit's grim conditions, but also hope for better times. It's also an excuse for people to dress up in costumes, play music, maybe have a few drinks, and just have fun in the streets of Midtown Detroit. It brings out a side of the city and its people that you don't see on a daily basis.
What are you dressed as?
Yvette Newell?
No, seriously, we're local belly dancers, so. Okay.
Yeah.
And so why'd you come out here today?
This is good. I like this. It feels like New Orleans down here. And I can't get to New Orleans right now, so this works.
There you go.
Hey. This is Heather Miller. Her disguise is a mask with disgraced and now imprisoned former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's face pasted on it.
Well, actually, this comes from an old Kwame poster that says Moving Detroit Forward that was mailed to our house during his first term. And I thought it'd be funny to photocopy it and give him some little red horn.
Another person wearing a sandwich board made up to look like a Detroit bus told me through his mask that his costume mourned the loss of night bus service in the city.
And the ghost of the night bus service that was cut, coming back to haunt the Nain Rouge who cut my service.
So, yeah, things in Detroit have been pretty terrible lately. The Nain Rouge is apparently winning, and he knows it.
And back, loser!
As the marsh winds its way through the streets, the Nain's disembodied voice keeps taunting the revelers.
I keep the street lights on during the day and burn them out at night. I raised your water rates.
And then the marsh ends with the ritual banishment. In the old days, that meant burning the Nain in effigy or throwing him into the Detroit River. That custom is toned down a bit these days. Everyone gathers outside Detroit's Masonic Temple. Local TV host Devin Skillian plays the crowd's role as the Nain's enemy. This year, one running joke was that the Nain was trying to become the city's emergency manager. A giant Nain Rouge for emergency manager banner was unfurled.
Last year, you stood at this very spot and announced your candidacy for emergency manager. Nice campaign you ran. That didn't work out. What exactly are you telling us you're doing this year?
I wasn't running for EFM last year, Devin. I announced I was managing your emergency into the biggest catastrophe possible. I told you before, I am the boogeyman you are all afraid of. And now Detroit is in shambles. And your government has collapsed. Your democracy is in ruins. The Tigers lost heart. After 300 years, there's only one thing left for me to do. I'm going on vacation!
But Skillian told the Nain he couldn't quit because he was being fired.
We don't stay in the ashes in Detroit. We rise from the ashes. To quote the famous John Blutarski at Animal House, nothing is over till we say it is.
And that was that. Everyone went their separate ways after a rare afternoon of festivity and hope in Detroit. I asked Nain-goer Josh Diskin why he still believes in a city that so many have fled.
I'm from here. Kind of feel like the rest of the people who came from here, who aren't here right now, are in the diaspora. And the rest of you are building it for them to come back.
Will people start coming back? Will Detroit avert total catastrophe and really start getting better? Will the Nain return to keep up the havoc he's wreaked for over 300 years? Check back on the first Sunday after the vernal equinox next year. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
And that wraps us up for Art Pod today. Always be sure to let us know what you think, what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of, and let us know about the Michigan artists and culture makers and thinkers that you think we should know about. Until then, I'm Kate Wells from Michigan Radio News.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.